This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. About 10 years ago, I spent a sweltering summer in Washington, D.C. On the weekends, I escaped the humidity one afternoon by ducking into the National Gallery to see a monumental exhibition on the art of Mark Rothko. I'd grown up being fascinated by his art, by his giant, looming color fields. But on this day, in the appropriately darkened downstairs gallery spaces, I sunk in to Rothko. You can feel yourself absorbed into his paintings in a way few painters can replicate. These paintings inspire meditation. A few years later, I was in Houston, made a pilgrimage to the Rothko Chapel, a space dedicated to the quiet, spiritual nature of his work. It is to this day one of the most memorable art experiences I've ever had. A new biography, Toward the Light in the Chapel, explores Rothko, the painter and the man, from his family's migration to the U.S. from Russia, to his brief and unhappy time at Yale University, to his ascendance in the art world as part of a radical group of abstract artists that challenged the ideas of what visual art could be, to his crippling depression and death. You can join our conversation at 860-275-7266, comment on our website WNPR.org, or find us on Facebook and Twitter at Where We Live as we consider the life and the work of Mark Rothko. The book is called Toward the Light in the Chapel. Annie Cohen-Solal joins us by phone today from France. She's the writer of this biography, and it's a lovely portrait of Rothko, and we're so pleased to have you here, Annie. Thank you so much for joining us on Where We Live.
Hi.
I also want to welcome in Susan Talbot, who is the director and CEO of the Wadsworth Athenaeum Museum of Art right here in Hartford. And Susan, it's good to see you once again. Thank you so much for coming in.
Pleasure.
Annie, I'm wondering if you could just first start by telling us the early life story of Mark Rothko. We think of him, of course, as one of the great American painters, but it's an American story that, like so many Americans of the early 20th century, did not start indeed in America. It started in Europe. Where did Mark Rothko come from?
Okay, so he was born in 1903 in Dvinsk, which was at the time part of the Russian Empire, and within the Russian Empire, part of the place called the Pale of Settlement, which was designed for the Jews to live into. His family was a very secular Jewish family. The father was a pharmacist and so on, but he was put in a Talmud Torah school, the little boy, just so that he would escape the threat of being put in the draft of the Russian army. So basically, although his family was secular, he went to a Jewish religious school until the age of 10. And at the age of 10, in 1913, he immigrated to the United States, going to Portland, Oregon, where part of his family was. And what is extremely interesting is 1913 is also the year of the Armory Show.
How much did the early teachings in the Jewish tradition, how much do you think that stuck with him throughout his life, given the fact that he was known as an art insider, a secular Jew, certainly in New York throughout the better part of his career? How much do you think that the early spirituality influenced him?
Yeah, it's a very interesting question. I think it installed the intellectual paradigm inside of his life. He always would remain an intellectual. His painting was a painting of ideas. He was a writer. He was a political activist. He was an educator. He was very interested in, he always communicated with museums, actually attacked American museums by writing petitions, writing letters, writing notes. And I think that the secret of his life as a painter is the book he wrote in 1940 called The Artist's Reality. For a whole year, he put aside his paintings, his brushes, and wrote a book in which he revisits the history of art since, basically the Egyptian, antiquity. And he invented a whole, element for putting the artist at the core of a society. He said, art is a social function. So for him, being an artist was actually having the most important activity in a society. Mm. And I think this has to come from his, education in the Talmud Torah, although he was completely secular. He never went into a synagogue in his life. And the Rothko Chapel that was, discussed earlier is an ecumenical place. It's a place where it's not even a religious place. So there's nothing mystical, but something spiritual or ethical in his approach to art.
There's also something quite frankly European about this idea that we in America have never quite grasped, this sense that the artist is at the center of the world in a way that America's never quite grasped. Americans, yes. And he seemed to feel that something else, a business person or a sports figure, should be our central figure, not an artist.
Pioneers, you know, the United States is more about pioneers and bankers than about artists, right?
Yeah.
But things changed, you know, in the 70s, you know, where artists were legitimized, were really made as heroes by somebody called Leo Castelli, and something changed, you know, in the art world and the art market and so on. But before that, it was a tough life to be an artist in the United States. You're absolutely right. So Rothko did bring over, you know, from Europe, this absolute conviction that art carries over something much more than, you know, than only, you know, colors on the painting. It's much more, it has something much more with, you know, spiritual values, ethical values, and even he was, I mean, something even prophetic. You know, I think that the art world is an allegory of social order, personally. And Rothko grabbed that idea very much so. As much did Dominique de Ménil, you know, who was his patron for the Rothko Chapel. She was also European. She was also an immigrant, not from the same kind of immigrant, because she was extremely rich and extremely leftist. But nevertheless, this chapel is a new kind of institution that, you know, didn't exist before in the United States, where a lot of, you know, I mean, religious leaders from the whole world or political leaders come to stay or come to give lectures. You know, the Dalai Lama, Desmond Tutu, Nelson Mandela, they all go to the Rothko Chapel.
Mm. We're talking with Annie Cohen-Solal, whose book is called Mark Rothko, Toward the Light in the Chapel. Also joining us today as we talk about the art and the life of Mark Rothko is Susan Talbot, the director and CEO of the Wadsworth Athenaeum here in Hartford. Susan, did you want to pick up on some of what we've been hearing?
What I think is so interesting about Rothko is that despite his tremendous intellectualism, he also, at a certain point in the late 40s, decided not to write about his work, not to talk about his work. And so there was this kind of push and pull, this dichotomy there. And what was so touching to me about Rothko is that he loved when people would stand in front of his work and tears would come out of their eyes because they were so moved by it. Mm-hmm. So it went really beyond intellectualism. It went beyond theory.
Sure.
He was so interested in that transcendent quality. And I think going back to Dominique de Ménil, the Ménils were so interested in that transcendent quality. And I think that for me, I've had that feeling more often at the Ménil museums, like the Dia Art Center in New York or the Ménil in Houston, because that was what they were really, really interested in.
But Annie, talk this through, because this is so important, this idea that this in some ways hyper-intellectual, someone who did consider the place of the artist and hung in the 1940s, 50s, and 60s with some of the great minds of the art world thinking and talking about this, that his work does indeed inspire this sort of transcendent moment, even if that is not what he specifically said when he talked about the art. I mean, that's a bit of a contradiction, but it's also what I think makes the work so amazing.
I mean, I think the word emotion is essential, Susan. I think you're totally right. You know, Rothko wanted to build bridges between emotion and ideas.
Yes.
And that's exactly what he did. I think he's really crossing all possible boundaries. That's why I like your work of transcendent moment. I think that he worked, first of all, he was a figurative painter until the 40s, and then he went through a big aesthetic evolution. Then he became abstract colorist. So his colors, his paintings were floating rectangles of colors floating on top of the other one. And then in the late decade of his life, before committing suicide in the 60s, he turned his interest into light. So with the light which emerged from his paintings, he was able to pull the viewer, the public, into the canvases. And that's something very, very original and very forward-thinking. You know, it's the spatial turn into art.
Yes.
I think all that is really unveiling him as an incredibly creative and even an avant-garde character in the art world.
In your book, you quote him from a magazine column in which he talks about painting these large pictures. He says, "I realize that historically the function of painting large pictures is something very grandiose and pompous. The reason I paint them, however, I think it applies to other painters I know, is precisely because I want to be intimate and human. To paint a small picture is to place yourself outside your experience, to look upon an experience as a stereopticon view or with a reducing glass. However, you paint the larger picture, you are in it. It isn't something you command." That's a beautiful idea, and it really does get to what Susan was talking about. And it's just you see these large works and you feel subsumed by them in a way that a smaller painting, a less grand painting, just couldn't do.
Sorry, Susan, go ahead.
Well, I just wanted to say, and in fact, it was characteristic of so many of the abstract expressionists, because that sense of scale was one of the characteristics of that movement. But even to the point where the artists themselves were in the painting as they were painting it.
Yes.
So artists like Pollock and then later Morris Lewis would put their canvases down on the floor and then step on them and drip their paint or pour their paint.
Sure.
So that the artists themselves, the whole experience from the making of the painting to the exhibiting of the painting to the viewing of the painting was all about that scale and being inside of it rather than being a viewer, than being separated from it as a viewer is.
Exactly. Yeah. And what Rothko wanted, you know, what he demanded is that art be an experience. You know, that the viewer interact with the painter, with the art, that there's a metamorphosis, something that changes him.
I'm wondering though if you can quickly talk about how, and we're going to talk more with Susan Talbot about these other artists who were in this sphere that he worked in, how his work and his way of approaching art was so much different, Annie, than those other names that we've heard of Jackson Pollock or even Robert Motherwell. Some of this work is all tied together in galleries like the Wadsworth Athenaeum, but it was created in a very different way. How can you describe his difference in the way he approached abstract expressionism?
Rothko, you know, immigrated in the U.S., and then he suffered all the wounds of the immigrants. You know, he went to Yale. He was extremely bright, but at Yale it was a time of rejection of the immigrants, and he felt anti-Semitism there. He felt that, you know, the university was really made for the WASPs and the athletes, and he was none of that. So basically, he had to reinvent himself through the art world, and he really was not feeling at ease with American institutions. So he fought American institutions, which is not the way, Pollock behaved. Rothko was really a rebel. You know, he was very politically minded, very, very active. He was also an educator, and he believed in art education until, you know, the Rothko Chapel is also some place which, you know, aims at educating the audience, being a threshold to action. So in this respect, he's different from them. And his research, actually, he's going to go, you know, on his own, you know. The one who is the most important within this group for him was Clifford Still, who was, you know, who invited him in San Francisco and who made him shift to abstraction, I think. Mm-hmm. Susan?
Yeah, I think so also. I mean, I think that as in any movement, there are artists within a movement who gravitate toward each other, who affect each other, whose ideas, there's a lot of cross-pollination of ideas. And certainly abstract expressionism was one of those movements. So the friendship between Gottlieb and Rothko, I think, also resulted in certain similarities in their approach, whereas Pollock was very, very different, I would say. So as in any movement, there are artists who have synchronicities and artists who are working in other ways, but yet there's an overlay of similarity and an overlay of ideas that resonate with each other to create this movement. Sometimes I think that movements are created as much by the critics and the market as they are by the artists.
When we come back, we're going to be talking more about the market and the idea of art as commerce, something that Mark Rothko rejected even as he was becoming one of the most famous artists in the world. The book is called Toward the Light in the Chapel, and the author is Annie Cohen-Solal, and she's talking with us by phone today. Susan Talbot, who's the director and CEO of the Wadsworth Athenaeum Museum of Art here in Hartford, she is joining us in studio. You can join us as well, 860-275-7266, as we consider Mark Rothko here on Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Today in the program, we're talking about a new biography called Toward the Light in the Chapel, about the artist Mark Rothko. Of course, one of the most important artists of the 20th century. He died very tragically of his own hand. He influenced so many other artists, and we're talking not just about his work, but also his life and some of the life of the abstract expressionists, many of whom are gathered in gallery spaces at the Wadsworth Athenaeum. So Susan Talbot joins us. She's director of the Wadsworth. The biographer of Mark Rothko, Annie Cohen-Solal, joins us by phone today. I'm wondering, Susan, if you can just talk about the art in this context. We can talk all we want about the history of these men and some women from the abstract expressionist period who all worked together and knew each other and were rivals in New York City, but you have them on display like right next to each other in Hartford right now.
Yes. You know, we've been going through this five-year renovation, and we're about to reopen the entire museum in mid-September. But we have been opening in stages, and right now we have our renovated contemporary galleries, but also our post-war galleries. And in those post-war galleries, you can really see a great selection of the abstract expressionist movement, including a Rothko painting from 1949, just as he was moving into the works that he's most known for. It's when he stopped being a realist painter in many ways, or using realist imagery, and became a total abstractionist. So it's very interesting to see this mid-career work of his. But the artist and sculptor Tony Smith was very connected to the museum and also friends with all of these abstract expressionists, and created his own personal art collection, and decided at a certain point to give that entire collection to the Wadsworth Athenaeum. And so our great Jackson Pollock, the Rothko that I just talked about, works by Barnett Newman, etc., are all gathered together in one gallery with some of the smaller scale work of Tony Smith. And so I hope that the listeners will come in. Here's my blatant ad for the Wadsworth Athenaeum. I hope that your listeners will come to see these works in the flesh. But also throughout the other two galleries of post-war work, we have works by really the whole movement, the whole abstract expressionist movement, including two of the women, Lee Krasner, who was married to Jackson Pollock, and Helen Frankenthaler, who was married to Greenberg. And Greenberg was the art critic who really encouraged the abstract expressionists, who wrote about them. Sometimes he didn't get it quite right, but he wrote about them. And I think it was Greenberg, and Annie, correct me if I'm wrong, who coined the term abstract expressionism. And so,
yeah, it was him.
Yes. And so we have all of this work in our galleries right now.
You know, I'm just reading a note here from the Associated Press today, Annie, that there's going to be an auction of work, including a Vincent van Gogh, but the auction house offering, amazingly, a Mark Rothko untitled Yellow and Blue on May 12th for somewhere between $40 and $60 million. And I think about that in the context of the stories that you tell about Mark Rothko's incredible depression around the idea of his art as commerce. Can you talk about that? Because I think it's such an important part of his story.
Listen, I need to tell you something. I just had lunch in Paris with one of the lawyers who was doing the lawsuit when he had passed away, and when they discovered that the gallery, who was his gallery, had really robbed most of the things. It's extraordinary because it epitomizes the fight between the market and another, you know, another dimension of the art that we can call, you know, spiritual values, you know. And Rothko was a very successful painter. His gallerist was Sidney Janis. Everything went incredibly well, and he was selling his signature style. Then in 1959, he's getting a commission from the Bronfman family for the Seagram building on Park Avenue, and they ask him to do the panels inside the Four Seasons restaurant. This is an extraordinary, I mean, prestigious commission. He works on that for 1 year, and then he decides not to do, to stop the contract, to reject the contract. Why does he do so? Because he feels that he does not want to be pulled into, that his art be pulled exclusively into the market. And that's the very moment where he just distanciates himself from the values, the capitalist values of American society, reaching out, anticipating to other values, which we can call ethical. So if Rothko commits suicide, it's most probably because he was harassed by his dealer. And so he took away his life, physical life, but his art perdures. And his art, the Rothko Chapel, as you said at the beginning, is a place which is attracting, you know, people from the whole world globally, you know. And this is a place which empowers every single visitor. It's a place, as Dominique Dominil said, it's a sacred place for all at all times. So it's open, it's free, it's available. You don't need to have a PhD to, you know, to be confronted with the art. Mm. So through emotion, the dialogue with the art world turns you into, it's a, like a threshold to action. It's like an experience of empowerment. So Rothko, by rejecting that his art be totally, you know, I mean, a slave of the market, I mean, went into, in a completely anticipatory way, into what exists today, you know.
Susan, could you just pick up on that, though? Because the art world right now is so consumed with this sort of dichotomy of art being something that comes up from warehouses and young people striving to do something brand new, and then grand institutions vying for multi-million dollar paintings. And you know, obviously, as Andy just said, this was right in the center of Rothko's struggle as well back in the 1950s and 1960s. And it still goes on today, because I'm just wondering what we should learn from all this, especially given the context of this great man's, you know, tragic life.
Yes. Well, one thing that's going on in the art world right now, which is unusual and has its pluses and minuses, is that contemporary art has just exploded. And so when you say that Rothko is going for 40 to 60 million, and that might sound like a great deal of money, nevertheless, there's work by contemporary artists like Jeff Koons, for instance, that sells in that scale, that sells for that amount. There are living artists today whose work sells at auction for those amounts of for that amount of money.
Yeah.
And so it's
yeah.
unusual. Because in Rothko's time, contemporary artists weren't valued the way they are now. And so for me, because my field is contemporary art, I'm thrilled that the market is so strong for living artists so that they can actually be artists, make their art. There are also downsides, however, because when so much money is involved, I think that artists are affected by that, and that ability to make enormous sums of money affects the way they approach their work. And so there's an upside and a downside to this, but it is unusual. The one other thing I want to say about Rothko and the abstract expressionists in terms of their immigrant status is that it was really abstract expressionism that put America on the map in the art world and turned the art world away from Paris and toward New York.
And Annie, I'll give you the last word here. We just have a minute or so left to pick up on that thought.
Yeah, no, this is very true. I mean, I would say that the fact that the Rothko paintings are being sold for something like $80 million, and that was the last thing. It's one marker, okay? The financial marker is one marker, but there's another one. So basically, he wins on all sides. You know, Mark Rothko wins on all sides. Yes. That's what I want to say.
Well, and indeed, as we can talk about the commerce of art, and we can talk about a lot of things. But as I said at the top, if you get a chance to go to the Rothko Chapel and sit as I did quietly by myself and absorb this work, or absorb the work at the Wadsworth Athenaeum or the many other places, you can see the work. It is indeed not just worthwhile, but in many ways life changing. The book Toward the Light in the Chapel tells the story of Mark Rothko. The author is Ani Cohen Solal. Thank you so much for your time. I truly appreciate it.
Thank you, John. Thank you.
And thank you also to Susan Talbot, who's director and CEO of the Wadsworth Athenaeum Museum of Art. Thank you so much for sharing some of your stories as well, Susan. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you.
We're going to head to a break right now, where some of my colleagues are going to tell you how you can support public radio, something like great art museums. It needs your support in order to survive and thrive. We'll be right back after that with more Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Coming up on tomorrow's program, a new biography celebrates the life of pioneering African-American journalist Ethel Payne. We'll talk to the author of Eye on the Struggle to find out how Payne documented history while also breaking down journalism's race and gender barriers. Hope you can join us for that conversation. And right after our show at 10 o'clock, hope you can join us for another conversation with Tom Ashbrook on Point. Our political analyst and Salon columnist Bill Curry will be a special guest of Tom Ashbrook, talking about the big announcement by Hillary Clinton over the weekend that she's getting into the presidential race. No big surprise there. And what's going to happen tonight when Marco Rubio gets in. So join our own Bill Curry today at 10 o'clock on Point. We've just been talking about Mark Rothko in a new biography called Toward the Light in the Chapel, and about his massive color fields and the way that you can sink in to these large paintings in a somewhat spiritual, metaphysical way. Well, there's a new exhibit at the New Britain Museum of American Art that maybe is slightly different. It's called Angry Robots Liquefied My Brain. It's on view now May 31st at the New Britain Museum of American Art in the new Now Gallery. And the artist, Carl Lund, is a local artist who is behind this. And Carl, thank you so much for joining us. I really appreciate it, and congratulations on this exhibit.
Thank you, John. Thanks so much for having me.
So first of all, just in the context of what we're talking about here, Mark Rothko, mid-century abstract expressionist, large color fields, and there's a style of painting that we all know as a vernacular now, as people who love art, that comes out of that. When you draw robots and giant sea lizards, where are you coming from? Is it a place informed by something you grew up with, or some idea of what you see in your head as art? Where do these robots come from?
Yeah, you know, I think it's painting things that I really love, and painting things that interest me, and painting things that I'd want to see myself. I love a lot of the abstract expressionists. One of my favorite painters is Ellsworth Kelly, who,
sure,
you know, with the color fields. I started to do some abstraction, but when I was in school and out of school, but I found this to be more tied in with some of the animation background that I've got. I think I'd want to add more to it if I started out with like a Rothko kind of.
Well, for people who who haven't seen your work yet, but they will go see it at the New Britain Museum of American Art. Describe what a typical Carl Lund painting is. I mean, give me a sense of what you're seeing here.
Wow, that's a good question. I think for me, I start out with like a core concept, something that I want to see. For instance, this battle between this strange, I call it a squeal, which is a cross between a squid and an eel, a squeal and this robot. And for me, it's you know, the squid are kind of this complex tangle of tentacles and energy, and then just the robot kind of fighting back with lots of laser color and just different things going on in that respect. I also like to start with a base. For me, is kind of like a background tessellation. I'm a huge M.C. Escher fan, and if I can work with something like that to kind of build on, that's what I like to do.
And so just that painting that you're describing, the title of it is actually, it helps to tell some of the story. The title of the painting is?
His lasers ripped through tentacle flesh like butter.
So here's something. I love this. But several of the paintings that in the exhibit actually have titles that they predict what's about to happen, as opposed to being about the actual action that is happening right there. And that's fascinating to me. It's almost as though you're setting up for people the next scene, the next frame in a movie that they just haven't seen quite yet.
I could see that. You know, I do have an animation background, and it's something that I'd like to get more into, having several paintings that kind of tell a visual story. Comics are a huge influence. And the new paintings that I did for this show, there are three large paintings that I did that I was able to zoom back, like my camera, if you will, and to show the bigger picture, where some of the earlier work in the smaller gallery there at the New Britain Museum is more about like portraits or more about the robot heads and design and that type of thing. And so it was a wonderful opportunity to be able to zoom back and show the entire picture of, you know, really what's going on.
If you've been influenced by comic book art or science fiction, 860-275-7266. If you want to join us, you can always tweet us at Where We Live. Talk about the influence of science fiction. One of the things that I loved reading my dad's science fiction book collection, especially when I was young, is you could pick up the cover and you'd get such a vibrant idea of what the book was about to be. And it was interesting. There were two different types of books. They may have both been about space, but if one had a cover that just sort of suggested it might be a story about people, I was like, yeah, I'll put this back. But if the other cover had a story that was clearly illustrated by robots and spaceships and outer space phenomenon, I would immediately pick it up and start to rifle through it. Did you do the same thing?
Oh, I still do that. And I'm still, you know, I got to say, I'm a more of a visual person. I still look at books with, you know, before I go to bed. I'm such a love looking at pictures. And so I was the same way too, and I still am. I was heavily influenced by a show that was in, I think, 1980 at the New Britain Museum of Art that was a science fiction show. And a lot of it was painters from all over the world who did science fiction art, book covers and that type of thing, and science fiction fantasy. And it was wonderful, and that really had a huge impact on me. So that's definitely a part of it.
And what about comic book art, too? Because comics, of course, have become so important in popular culture. I mean, I felt like a nerdy kid when I was getting them in the little, you know, paper bags in the mail back in the 1970s, and I'd read the Fantastic Four. And these are my favorite things in the world. But I never thought that it would become a kind of a high art form. But it seems as though comic book illustration, and certainly what it's grown into is graphic novels, have become this incredibly important part of art in a way that I guess I wouldn't have imagined when I was a 10-year-old kid ripping open my Fantastic Fours.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I feel so bad for so many of those comic book artists, Jack Kirby and a lot of the Marvel stable of artists that they had, because, you know, they didn't get a lot of credit for what they were doing, and they were just churning the stuff out, and it was groundbreaking. And I mean, you know, and you get Roy Lichtenstein kind of doing his thing and appropriating some of that, but then going on to develop this his own unique kind of comic language for in the fine art realm. But I think the comic thing is just, I'm amazed at it. You know what I mean? There's really rich storylines. There are really rich characters. There's so much to pull from there, you know, and I think it's nice that it's being recognized more as, you know, as an art form and not the whole Comic-Con thing, and it's mega huge.
But do you ever feel disappointed that whether it's the representations of comic books in major films now, or even just the way in which movies have taken over and stylized science fiction, it seems as though a lot of the way of depicting science fiction that you grew up with and I grew up with, and a lot of the way that you depict it in your art through drawing and through vibrant colors, but clearly something that's coming from an imagination. I don't know. It feels like something is lost with computer animation. It's too realistic. It's too obvious that this dragon could be real to me. It doesn't feel as fantastical, perhaps. Do you feel like we lose something there?
You know, I kind of do, too. It's a weird line to cross. For so long, I think I was waiting for the effects to be able to catch up to that kind of thing. So movies like the Lord of the Rings trilogy could happen and they could do it in a good way. But at the same time, I totally agree with you, too. If you can visualize everything and anything, then where's the kind of magic? You know, where do you find that magic, you know? And so, you know, comic books still, it's there's that whole visual kind of narrative on the page, and that's an art form to in its own right, you know what I mean? And you can call that storyboarding, but I think when it's on pages and comic books, it's different. You get lost in it, you know what I mean? And if you had comic books as a kid, I'm sure you got that energy of like, oh, I'm so into this. I just wanted to keep going, you know? And movies, sometimes, you know, there's less to be imagined or less. It feels like it's too much presented on a wonderful plate.
And unfortunately, sometimes in these same movies, you have to grapple with the dialogue, which frankly is not as good as the dialogue that was written in the comic books in the 1970s. Oh, we're talking with Carl Lund. He's a local artist whose work is on display at the New Britain Museum of American Art. Angry Robots Liquefied My Brain is the exhibit at New Now Gallery at New Britain Museum of American Art. It's through May 31st. Are you scared of robots? I mean, are robots taking us over? Is that your take on the robot?
You know, it's not really in these. I could go either way. You know what I mean? I think, like I tried to say earlier, I get a spark of an idea and then I want to paint it. And if I think it through too much, it's overwhelming. You know, there's one piece in that show that took me like 3 years to paint because it's a robot that's liquefying, I think, the Faneuil Hall Government Center in Boston.
Yeah, not Faneuil Hall. They're actually taking out Government Center, which not everyone loves. Yeah.
I had a hard time with that when I spent some time in Boston. It felt like, you know, Darth Vader's summer home or something like that. And I had a hard time having been in New York City during 9/11. And, you know, I was like, when I was painting that piece, I was like, okay, all the people have left the building. Nobody's getting hurt, you know, and it just took me a while to do it, you know. So I think I got off track there.
Well, here's what's interesting, though, is because the way technology has developed over time. I mean, I think we grew up with the idea of robots being something that could help us and something that could certainly scare the hell out of us or liquefy our brain. But then we see, you know, movies like Her from a few years back where someone falls in love with the personal assistant on their phone. And you start to think of robots are now such a real part of our lives that depicting a robot in the way you grew up with, I don't know, do you feel like it's a nostalgic view of robot as opposed to what we actually have right now, which is probably one in your pocket right now that will tell you where to go to lunch?
Yes, definitely. I think a lot of the robots in my pieces kind of come out of like this 50s, you know, science fiction kind of thing. You know, a lot of the covers and that you were talking about in some of the pulp magazines, the Lesser Collection, I think, is one that they have at the New Britain Museum, which is phenomenal. And I think I like that type of robot. I kind of try to put a little bit of a modern twist on some of mine, you know, using elements of pop culture that I grew up with. But yeah, I don't think mine are as threatening and all, but we'll see what happens.
We'll see what people feel. I have to ask you about this. You mentioned your love of M.C. Escher. You've also been inspired by and worked on a program inspired by Walter Wick's I Spy books.
Yeah.
Can you talk about that a little bit?
Sure. Right around 2001, late 2001, I had the opportunity to be a stop-motion animator on a series that Scholastic and HBO were doing based on Walter Wick's books. And he was peripherally involved, but he did visit the studio a couple times and introduced us to his work and, you know, talked about it. And so we animated all these, gosh, I think there are 22 episodes of you know, this kid's show that had characters, and they were kind of based on some of the sets or some of the pictures taken by Walter Wick, and they had to find things, and it was really fun. It was a great job. Talk about a good job.
It's a very good job, and still to this day, you're inspired by this idea of putting little things that people can find. You want people to look very closely at your work and say, oh, I see what he did there, right?
Yeah, yeah. And I started hiding airplanes, and I'm sure that came out of my experience on the Walter Wick show and Walter Wick's books. And you know, Walter Wick is really a hero of mine. he was kind enough to invite me over to his studio when I moved to Connecticut, and took me out for lunch, and it was just really cool. He's just such a wonderful guy, and he's made so many people so happy, you know. And if I could do something like that, that would be wonderful. But
how does it feel after having been inspired by this exhibit at the New Britain Museum so many years ago? How does it feel to have your own exhibit there on public view for people?
It's amazing. You know, it really is amazing. It's actually, I think, 35 years later. It actually overlaps the same dates that the other show is up. And you know, I haven't shown my artwork at tons of places. And, you know, I really would thank Douglas Highland and the museum there to really put me out there and go take a chance and show my work. I'm so grateful. It's been such a wonderful experience.
Yeah, you were telling me not so very long ago exhibiting in Starbucks, and now on in the big bright lights of the New Britain Museum of American Art, one of the really great art museums, not just in Connecticut, but in our entire region. Carl Lund's exhibit, Angry Robots Liquefied My Brain, on view through May 31st. You can find out more at nbmaa.org. Carl, thanks so much for coming in and sharing this work with us. I really appreciate it.
Thank you, John. It was awesome.
Well, and when we come back tomorrow, we're going to be talking about a new biography having to do with some of the history of African Americans in journalism. Hope you can join us for that conversation. Now I'm going to turn it over to some colleagues who are going to tell you how you can support public radio, including Where We Live and WNPR.